The House now comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Questions to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, malolele, and I acknowledge Tongan Language Week. Mr. Speaker, yes, and I do just want to reiterate or reinforce the statement made by Minister Andrew Little, in particular the best wishes of the government to those who were the victims on Friday of a horrendous violent attack, and of course reinforce that we will do all we can to learn from what has occurred in the lead up to those events going forward, including any legislative responses required.
How many more people could have been vaccinated by now if the government had secured additional vaccines 2 months ago?
Mr. Speaker, our vaccine rollout has always been based on the supply that we have, noting, of course, that we receive over the course of October the entirety of our Pfizer order, which is more than enough to vaccinate every single eligible New Zealander. What we've been seeing over the course of September, of course, through the outbreak, is the ability for us to surge up, meet the additional demand through the course of those months, and rather than cap that demand because of our limited supply, we've decided to meet it and then go through extraordinary efforts to, over the course of a 2 or 3 week period, match the gap in supply that then presented to us.
Does the extra supply announced today mean that she will bring forward the target of offering everyone a vaccine before the end of the year? If so, what is the new target date?
Mr. Speaker, we've always said that every New Zealander would have the ability to access a vaccine before the end of the year. That continues to be the case. Even when actually all of our supply came forward to October, we maintained that same principle. It's still, of course, on us, Mr. Speaker, making it as available as possible. We still need New Zealanders, of course, to take up that opportunity as well.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
To the Prime Minister, did she see any commentators earlier in the year confidently predicting that the vaccine program would fail to reach a target of 50,000 doses a day of the vaccine on average being delivered? And is she aware that the program is now delivering closer to 80,000 vaccines a day on average?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I did see some of that scepticism, and I think it's really testament to the New Zealanders who are coming forward to be vaccinated, and some of the figures are fantastic. We now have 62% of people aged 12 and over who have had at least one dose. But what I'm really heartened by is what we're seeing in the projections around New Zealanders who have both had their first dose but also booked for their first dose. 91% of people aged 65 plus are booked or have been vaccinated with at least one dose. Then 84% of people aged 40 plus, and it's even 81% of people aged 30 plus. So really good to see those high rates. We just want to see that continue, and we want it to be across the board.
The Prime Minister, how can New Zealanders prove that they have been vaccinated?
Mr. Speaker, at this point it's a manual process, those who need for any reason to demonstrate that they're being vaccinated are able to contact the Ministry of Health, who can provide them with documentation. What they're working on at the moment, though, is a digital solution which will be able to be utilised for multiple purposes, either domestically if they need to, or if, for instance, they need to produce vaccine passports overseas. There's a couple of templates, so there's not just one that's been used globally. We're working very hard to make sure that what we develop will be compatible with the requirements of overseas jurisdictions.
When will New Zealanders be able to easily provide electronic proof of their vaccination statement, as has been the case in many other countries now for months?
Mr. Speaker, keep in mind some of those countries have used them to access venues and the like. And of course, what we're trying to do is ensure that we have something that is able to be used when moving through borders as well. So multiple purposes. My understanding, my recollection from the timeline of health officials is that they're working on it currently. They're looking to have, I believe, something that will be available, I think, in the latter part of this year, so near the end of the year. But they'll want to, of course, make sure that they're trialling and piloting it. I'd have to say some of the digital solutions that our health team have worked on, be it the booking system, which prior to now didn't exist, improvements to the immunisation register, which previously, I have to say, we inherited a bit of a dog's breakfast on the immunisation register. And then also the work they've done to develop the COVID Tracer app just demonstrates the incredible work that that digital team has done.
Does she stand by her answer to oral questions from me on the 2nd of February in relation to vaccine passports that, quote, I have received copies of advice provided to the Minister of Transport around developments of this regime? And why are we still waiting for it 7 months later?
Mr. Speaker, the member conveniently left out that those briefings would have been around the IATA development that was underway. Of course, New Zealand wanted to make sure that we were following the guidelines that were being worked through internationally to ensure that there was something that would be interoperable. So that's what that briefing was about. And of course, as I've said, we are specifically working on an option that we believe should have interoperability, but at the moment, countries are working on their own passports. And so you're trying to get that dual purpose of having something that's readily available, but also having something that will be useful when New Zealanders travel.
So what advice, if any, has she received on whether law changes are needed to allow high-risk businesses to require employees to be vaccinated?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, that advice predominantly will be going to our Minister for Workplace Relations and our Attorney General, so I suggest a specific question to them.
Is it her plan that during any future outbreaks, as our level of vaccination increases, that New Zealand will be in a position to reduce the use of lockdowns and gathering size limits?
Look, I think it's everyone's goal to reduce the need for lockdowns. They're incredibly disruptive. They're very hard on people. They're very hard on businesses. So that is everyone's goal. Where our experts have really cautioned is just putting a single number on it. And I can see why when you look to some countries, which many members in this House hold up as being the beacons of vaccination programs, most of them still have restrictions in place in some form, and many of them sit somewhere between 70 to 80% of vaccination rates. So yes, we do want to see an end to those, but we haven't put a number on it. We want to encourage everyone to be vaccinated as soon as possible.
Does she agree that if months ago New Zealand had achieved the rate of vaccination that we are currently seeing, we would be in a position today where hospitality businesses would not need to be under a new alert level 2D?
Mr. Speaker, no, I absolutely disagree with that sentiment for two reasons. First of all, countries that started their vaccination programs in earnest in, say, February and even peaked around April or May, in some cases still have restrictions in place. They still have gathering limits in place. They still have things that are constraining their everyday lives. And in those places where they don't have that, they have record hospitalisation. So I think it's an overly simplistic analysis. The second issue I would point out to the members, the only thing that has constrained our vaccine rollout has been supply. We have had in place an order with Pfizer that covers our whole population. Pfizer, of course, have determined globally who receives their supply and when. So regardless, of course, we got allocations for quarter one, two, three, and four. And as with many countries, the bulk of ours are coming in quarter four, which is why we always designed a vaccine program that factored that in.
Question number two, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the Minister of Health. When he reportedly admitted recently there were gaps in hospital preparations for the Delta outbreak, what were those gaps?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, I draw the member's attention to my original statement reported in the New Zealand Herald on the 4th of September 2021, where I said, and I quote, most DHBs have done an extraordinary amount to be ready and prepared, and they have been. Some things I think could have been done a little better. There was extra funding provided last year and an online module for more nurses to do ICU learning so that they could go into an ICU environment if they were called for. Some DHBs got on top of it, others haven't so much. End quote. However, I will note that in response to the recent Delta outbreak, all DHBs have accelerated the training of additional nurses and ICU skills to ensure sufficient nurses are available. Last year, all DHBs were urged also to ensure their health workforce were properly fit tested for the P2 N95 masks. Many fulfilled that request, but some have not completed the task just yet.
Supplementary. What gaps were there in the pathway from ED to isolation at Middlemore Hospital that resulted in a subsequently coronavirus positive patient being placed in a shared room with other people, including a 91-year-old man?
Mr Speaker, the information available is that the patient that the member refers to was tested the day after he was admitted to hospital and returned a positive test. And it's not quite clear how that could have been detected without a test having been conducted at the time that it was.
Supplementary. How many staff at Middlemore have been asked to isolate due to this event?
Mr Speaker, I'm not familiar with that number, except to say that Middlemore Hospital and the County's Manukau District Health Board are doing an exemplary job in managing the pressure that they are under with COVID-19, running their COVID-19 wards, and making sure that their staff are kept safe with the appropriate PPE.
Supplementary. Does he consider this event to be serious, and if so, why does he not know the number of staff who may be required to isolate?
Mr Speaker, any patient who turns up to hospital with and detected with COVID-19 is a serious matter. We have geared up a system to deal exactly with that. That's why I went through the measures that DHBs have been required to go through, and it's why additional supplies of PPE and the appropriate training to go with that PPE and the additional support given to staff to manage that have been put in place.
Supplementary. Have there been any other incidents during the current outbreak where people in hospital waiting for a coronavirus test result have been placed in a shared space with general patients while they wait?
Well, Mr Speaker, it's not possible to say whether or not that is the case. Our response to COVID-19 is that anybody who is symptomatic or anybody who has been in a location of interest should get tested and do get tested. That is the way we keep track of what is happening, and that is the way we have managed the response for the current Delta variant outbreak that we're dealing with right now.
Supplementary. Should people in hospital who are being tested for coronavirus be placed on a general ward with other people?
Well, Mr Speaker, people typically don't go to hospital to be tested. If they want to be tested, they go to other places. But people turn up to hospital because they have other healthcare needs. And in this case, a patient turned up because he had other healthcare needs, was subsequently tested and returned a positive test.
He was on a general ward.
Question number three, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is
order.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by her statement that, quote, with COVID raging outside our borders and new, more transmissible strains emerging, we have had to both make continual improvements to strengthen our border while continuing to plan and prepare for managing any resurgence in the most effective way possible, end quote.
Mr Speaker, yes, as I previously described, all relevant agencies across government to make continuous improvements to our defence at the border and to plan for any resurgence in the community. This includes changes in anticipation of a variant of concern emerging in Aotearoa, New Zealand. These improvements include the wider use of pre-departure testing, continued improvements of our system of managed isolation, the introduction of restrictions on passengers coming from very high-risk countries, the extensive use of whole genome sequencing, wastewater testing, boosting surge testing capacity, system readiness planning and preparation, contact training, tracing capacity, requirements for face covering, updates to the New Zealand COVID Tracer and Bluetooth app. Mr Speaker, our preparedness is why, even in the middle of a community outbreak, New Zealand continues to have some of the lowest number of cases of any country in the developed world. Mala upito.
Supplementary. Does she agree with Professor Michael Baker that, quote, as soon as a positive person arrives in New Zealand MIQ, our risk of a local outbreak goes up exponentially?
Oh, Mr Speaker, and I do agree that, of course, as soon as you have COVID cases at your border, that does present risk, which is why we have such stringent arrangements. And even in this case, Mr. Speaker, that person having a test once they arrive, as soon as it was found to be positive, you have staff in full PPE transferring that person to a quarantine facility. We have regular testing of our staff. We have vaccination requirements of our staff and 160,000 people who have been managed through isolation and MIF facilities with very few incidents. It just so happens when you do have an incident, it can have a devastating impact, and that's obviously what many places have experienced.
Why then did the government decide to announce on the 9th of July that people returning from New South Wales would not need to get a pre-departure test before entering MIQ or coming to New Zealand and entering MIQ?
Mr. Speaker, because that was the advice provided by the Ministry of Health.
Why did the government accept that Ministry of Health advice, which amounts to saying there is more risk of catching COVID while going out to get a test than there is of that test catching a case of COVID?
Mr. Speaker, two things to keep in mind. We put in place pre-departure testing ourselves midway through our program as an extra layer. However, people are still coming into managed isolation facilities. So the advice of the public health team was that rather than most countries in the world where people are simply coming from everyday life and coming into New Zealand, we had a situation where New South Wales had already been in lockdown. So the view of the public health team was that because of multiple reasons, including the fact that they had already been in lockdown and that they would go straight into quarantine, that it was their view that they should come over on red flights and go straight in. Mr. Speaker, I would also add that there were some other factors there around the availability in red flights and things that were added complications.
Did the government make any representations to Australian authorities or to the airlines to try and coordinate pre-departure tests prior to repatriation flights leaving New South Wales, which might have addressed those complications the Prime Minister just mentioned?
Mr. Speaker, I just caution the member because the implication here is that had we had pre-departure testing, we wouldn't have the individual who came into New Zealand with a case, and that's simply not necessarily the case. It was a 72-hour prior pre-departure test, and from what I know of the timeline of this case, this individual could well have got their clear test, then been infected and then come into New Zealand. So I just want to just add that to the equation so that we don't end up down a wormhole. When it comes to whether or not we asked anyone else to facilitate, no, we did not ask New South Wales government in the middle of managing an outbreak whether or not they would test our people before they departed. However, they've always made available testing generally for those in Australia. We did, however, reach out to Border Force around assistance with the checking of pre-departure tests with other departees who weren't going into managed isolation. Keep in mind, of all the people who came home, I think we've had in total three or so cases who came out of New South Wales.
Is the Prime Minister saying that all those people who have a pre-departure test before boarding a flight to New Zealand from practically every other place in the world are not making a substantial contribution to reducing the chance of COVID getting out from a New Zealand MIQ?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I'm saying that it is not perfect. Absolutely not, because you go and get a test 72 hours before you depart, you still have a possibility of being infected in those 72 hours or indeed in your transit to New Zealand. And we've seen multiple situations where people have been infected with COVID-19 and often what is very long journeys back to New Zealand. So it is another layer. It is not a perfect layer. We do not rely on it. That is why we test people when they arrive as well, and we continue to test them throughout their duration here.
Does the Prime Minister regret the government's decision, which led to the person who came to New Zealand and brought Delta not having a pre-departure test just as Auckland enters its fourth week of level four lockdown?
Mr. Speaker, of course I would want to do... There is no way anyone in this house or anyone in New Zealand would want to be in the place we are with people in lockdown right now. Of course. But it is overly simplistic to imply that had that one thing been there, this wouldn't have happened. I don't think that's fair, particularly given what I recall of the timeline of when we believe this person became infected. I just don't think it's a fair summation.
Question number 4, Jane Logan.
Malo Alpito. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety and asks, is he confident that the government's policies are ensuring working people are safe and supported during the current COVID-19 outbreak?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, Malo Alpito, on behalf of the Minister, yes, the government has put in place extensive financial support, including the wage subsidy scheme, the leave support scheme and the short-term absence payment. Around 350,000 wage subsidy payments have been made since the 18th of August and around 2,500 leave support and short-term absence payments. We continue to ensure that people receive the support they need around their employment rights, making additional COVID-19 employment guidance available on the Employment New Zealand website, providing additional resources to our service centre to answer employment queries, and providing an additional early resolution service as part of the mediation service to help resolve employment disputes. At all times, normal employment law and health and safety requirements also continue to apply.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker. Will the Minister ensure that essential workers who have to stay home because they're unable to access appropriate childcare continue to be paid while they put the health and safety of their tamariki first?
Well, Mr Speaker, I am, on behalf of the Minister, I am advised that obviously the government has contracted OSCA childcare providers and licensed home-based education and care providers to provide that childcare to workers in alert level 4 in businesses and services. It's free of charge. It's offered for those aged 0 to 13. There is also the possibility for those at alert level 4 to expand their bubble in order to bring somebody in to provide that support for them as well. So I believe that the government is taking the steps it needs to provide that support.
Does the Minister believe the wage subsidy scheme is working for all working people in Aotearoa, including those in unstable work, casual contractors, migrant workers not able to access support, and ECE relief teachers?
Mr Speaker, I do believe that the wage subsidy scheme is working well. It is true to say that there is a wide variety of employment arrangements in New Zealand. One point I would like to make is that employers can apply on behalf of casual staff who work for them, and I would encourage them to do that. For those who fall outside of the criteria that the wage subsidy scheme has, there are supports in place through the Ministry of Social Development, and I encourage them to contact the Ministry about those.
How has the government been evaluating the coverage of the wage subsidy scheme and making any subsequent improvements for workers as we've moved between different alert levels over the last year?
There have been a couple of reviews of the wage subsidy scheme. One was undertaken by the Auditor General, actually. There's also been one that I believe it may have been Deloitte's did on behalf of the Ministry of Social Development. And there is ongoing work as we sit within each incarnation of the scheme to make sure we get it into the right shape.
What new support has the Minister put in place or advocated for to ensure all workers have access to financial support during this lockdown, even when their employer is not eligible, has not applied, or is not passing on their COVID-19 wage subsidy or leave support scheme?
Yeah, in any one of the 8 or 9
I was about to say, I'll pick up some of those points. The first one I would make is the one that I made in my primary answer. Employment law stands, and if there are examples of people who are not being paid in the way that they should be because of a decision of an employer, then there are rights, and as I have said publicly before, people should join a union, be part of a union, and make sure that those people are there to help them in situations like this. In terms of issues around migrant workers, there have been schemes in place to support migrant workers throughout this period of time, and there is a very small number of people still involved in some of those schemes. And beyond that, I go back to the Ministry of Social Development. They are there for situations where people fall outside of the working environment.
Did the Minister consider or provide, or any agencies, proactively contact employers who had COVID-related health and safety or employment relations complaints after the last two lockdowns to ensure that they would follow the law this time round?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister within the Minister's portfolio, I'm unable to provide that information today. I'm sure we can get back to the member on that. More generally, yes, there have been follow-ups, particularly through the wage subsidy scheme. We've had seen around $700 million returned from employers from the wage subsidy scheme that they've taken. And I do know that the employment parts of the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment are constantly following up complaints about things not just related to COVID, I might add, but where there are people believe there have been breaches of laws.
When the Minister mentioned adaptations for additional resources for the Centre and Early Resolution Service, is he confident that the system is responding to the COVID environment? And have there, for example, is there an online dispute resolution capacity adequate? Is the system coping with delays and bargaining?
I did warn the member earlier.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I don't have advice that the system isn't working. Clearly, under a COVID environment, there will be an increase in inquiries, and that's why I mentioned before that additional resourcing has been provided. And we continue to direct people to that resourcing. If the government were presented with concerns that there was inadequate resourcing, I'm very confident the Minister would approach the Minister of Finance with that matter.
Question number 5, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, does the Minister have confidence in the administration and timeliness of the COVID-19 wage subsidy scheme?
Mr. Speaker, Mala Upito.
Honourable Grant Robertson.
Yes, we have never had to stand up a scheme such as this in New Zealand's history, and in these circumstances I think the administration and timeliness of the scheme has been excellent. The wage subsidy scheme has so far made 1,133,379 payments since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. From time to time, administration errors can occur when staff are working around the clock, as happened last week when applications were not possible under the scheme for 2 hours and when the new form was uploaded. This is regrettable, of course, but does not take away from the excellent work that MSD has done here.
Will he extend the application deadline for the first fortnight the wage subsidy was available, given the early closure on the 2nd of September and portal issues on the 3rd of September meant some businesses were unable to apply?
Mr. Speaker, as was said at the time, anyone who had issues during the two-hour period that the applications were not possible should make themselves known to MSD. I am aware that 430 people have done so, and MSD is now working that through with them.
How many wage subsidy applications were not processed within the three-day time target set by his government in the current wage subsidy round, and how many are still outstanding?
Mr. Speaker, the information I have here in front of me is that 91% of applications have been paid within 3 working days.
Why has the government taken reference to the three-day target off their website?
Mr. Speaker, I wasn't aware that we had.
Does the Minister appreciate that delayed wage subsidy payments are creating uncertainty and stress for New Zealanders at a time they are making sacrifices and have done everything the government has asked of them?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I absolutely accept that many businesses are in a very stressful period at the moment, and we're doing our level best to support them through that. As I said in my previous answer, 91%, I'm advised that 91% of paid applications have been paid within 3 days. What I can say is that the most common reason for a delay in applications is where the information held by Inland Revenue about a business is different from the information on the Ministry of Social Development's application, on the application form. That is the single most pressing issue. So if I can put out a plea, Mr. Speaker, for people when they are applying to ensure that the details on their application form with MSD are the same as the details that are held by Inland Revenue about that business.
Question number six, David Seymour.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Does she stand by her statement from yesterday that, quote, we also want to increase our testing of people who are crossing the Auckland boundaries to ensure we don't see any spread behind beyond Auckland, end quote? And if so, why hasn't saliva testing been rolled out more widely in Auckland and at its boundaries?
Mr. Speaker, yes. And to answer the second half of the question, as we speak, the Ministry of Health is working on contracting a provider to support border testing with saliva testing. The one point I would make, though, is that the ability to do border testing is in no way contingent on having saliva testing. Yes, it's fantastic to have it available. It's being used both in our managed isolation facilities, where we have a contract for a provider there, and also it's being used by a number of firms privately. But border testing is not contingent on having it, but it is something that the Ministry of Health is contracting for.
How is it possible that just 800 saliva tests are currently being done each week, when the government signed a contract for 20,000 a week all the way back in May?
Again, Mr. Speaker, keeping in mind that saliva testing that we've contracted to be provided is doing exactly the same job as the nasal swabs, albeit obviously through collecting in a different way. So it's not as if by not having that scaled up that somehow we have lost something. It is an extra additional tool that gives some choice to staff members around the way that they're being tested, because we totally understand, and anyone who has been swabbed will know, how uncomfortable it would be to have that done on a regular basis. So the reason for the numbers I've had is simply for uptake and the way it's being rolled out, but we are looking at using it for returnees as well, so I expect those numbers will only continue to increase, and as I say, we're contracting separately for border testing as well.
So is saliva testing a very good thing when the government contracts 20,000 saliva tests a week, and not really necessary when it's only doing 800 a week?
Mr. Speaker, again, if the member wants the intricate details on how the Ministry of Health intends to scale up to what they've contracted to, I invite the member to ask the Minister for COVID-19 response, or feel free to put a question like this on notice, and I will happily bring down some of the plans that the Ministry of Health have around scaling up for their contract, because it's just not information I have in front of me, and I'm sure the member would appreciate that.
Does the Prime Minister stand by her statements earlier this afternoon about how difficult and complex it is to negotiate a vaccine swap with another country?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I only said it this afternoon and I still mean it.
When did she realise it?
Mr. Speaker, again, also, the member wasn't obviously listened to the entire stand-up, because this notion of vaccine swaps are still actually sale and purchase agreements individually. They're just in both directions, if that is indeed what people do.
Member, just stop the noise. It seems weird for a mask.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think the quality of the interjection was either lowered or raised by the fact that a mask exists sat between it. Mr. Speaker, so look, that was just a commentary on that. As I've said, we've been working on some of these arrangements over the past couple of weeks.
Is the Prime Minister saying they only started to negotiate a swap of vaccines with other countries in the past couple of weeks?
Mr. Speaker, I've already corrected the member on his assertions around swaps, and if the member listened to the exchange between myself and the actual Leader of the Opposition, you would have heard me answer the questions around supply.
Question number seven, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the Minister for COVID-19 response. Has the Director General of Health exempted under Clause 9 of the COVID-19 Public Health Response Point of Care Tests Order 2021 any point-of-care tests from the prohibitions against them in Clause 7 of the order, and what is current government policy towards rapid COVID-19 tests?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Malarilele, Mr. Speaker. I'm advised that to date a total of 34 letters of authorisation by the Director General of Health have been issued under the Clause 9 of the COVID-19 Public Health Response Point of Care Tests Order 2021, covering the import and supply of or use of rapid COVID-19 tests. 33 of the authorisation letters related to rapid molecular tests that were already in use in laboratories in the National COVID-19 Testing Laboratory Network prior to the order being issued, or to their use in laboratories that have operationalised PCR tests since the order was issued. In relation to the second part of the member's question, the Ministry of Health is investigating options for the utilisation of rapid antigen tests in certain settings, such as for the healthcare workforce, and as part of the point of arrivals trial within the Reconnecting New Zealand Work Programme. One letter of authorisation has been issued to allow the Ministry of Health to import a quantity of rapid antigen tests so that the potential use of those tests under the public health response can be evaluated and or piloted.
Just in relation to the last part of the answer, in relation to the one letter of authorisation to allow the Ministry to import, I think you said rapid antigen tests for trials, when was that letter issued, and when will those tests be imported into New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have an exact date. It would have been within the last few months, though.
Will the government allow rapid antigen tests to be used for essential workers crossing the Auckland boundary who are now required to be tested weekly, and if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, that's not part of our current expectation. We are looking to ensure that a variety of different testing methodologies are available, including saliva testing and nasal pharyngeal and oral throat swabs, as are currently used. We want to have a high degree of efficacy for those tests. We're not proposing at this point rapid antigen tests.
When the Ministry of Health says that, quote, increased surveillance testing in healthcare, border, quarantine and essential workers is a key focus to help stamp out Auckland's Delta outbreak, why are no rapid COVID-19 tests being used when they could deliver a lot of surveillance tests very quickly?
In the case of New Zealand, we were aiming to identify every single case of COVID-19 that might exist within the community. We need to have a test that is as accurate as possible. And a PCR test, be it saliva or through a throat or a nasal swab, is regarded internationally as the gold standard for reliability of testing methodologies. Other countries that are using things like rapid antigen tests, they are doing so in the context of widespread community transmission, where missing a few cases here and there has a lower consequence than it does in New Zealand.
Has he seen the comments of Dr. Sean Hendy in relation to rapid antigen tests, quote, if we had them widely available now, I think they would be a very useful tool in combating Delta, and will the government be listening to its own expert modeller?
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course, there are a range of experts the government listens to, and unfortunately, they don't always agree with one another. And so, yes, Professor Hendy's advice is a stream of advice that we do take into consideration, and will continue to do so. We do have a team at the moment, a dedicated technical team, working on different testing methodologies. They are producing advice for the government on emerging testing technologies and other existing technologies that are out there that we're not currently using. Of course, we're following that. We're awaiting some of that advice, and we are eagerly anticipating some of it.
The time for oral questions is concluded.